Hey, it's nice to be here. There's not a plant up there. There's a mouse. I'll say more about that in just a minute. I'm in statistics, horticulture, and biometry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mike Havey is in the audience as one of my colleagues in horticulture, so we see each other on a regular basis. So how did I get here? I didn't start out dealing with bioinformatics. I don't even have any training in bioinformatics. Okay. But I had undergraduate training in math, and then I did graduate work in statistics and biostatistics. I took one genetics course from Seymour Benzer, who's there communing with a fly. But I found that I really liked computers, I liked math, and I liked biology. And I found a way to combine those by becoming a faculty member at Madison in biometry. And ended up, statistics was one of my homes, and I got to choose another department, and horticulture rose to the top. Been there about 30 years. So the way I got back into genetics after that early introduction was that in 1989, a little over 20 years ago, two different scientists, I should say more about my position. So I do joint work. Part of my work, my teaching responsibility is collaborating with people like Mike. And two collaborators brought me Landon-Bostian's papers independently, and I thought, there must be something here. And soon after that, I started working with Tom Osborne and worked with him for about 10 years on Brassica. And then as that was winding down, I started working with Alan Addy, who's pictured there. I don't have a picture of Tom, unfortunately. So the project I'm working with Alan Addy is what I'm mostly going to use as a focal point here. Is looking at obesity and diabetes with a mouse model. So many people are obese, but only a fraction of those people get diabetes. Why is that? So in this case, we have on the left an obese B6 mouse, which doesn't get diabetes. And on the right is an obese BTBR mouse, which does. And you can see evidence at the bottom. The older BTBR obese mice have much higher glucose levels, and lower insulin levels, whereas the B6, when they get obese, they keep their glucose levels at the same amount by boosting their insulin. So the BTBR can't boost their insulin. So we did a lot of work on clinical studies, but we early on got into microarrays, and this is a large experiment we did jointly with Rosetta, a Merck company that's since gone under. But we had the same B6 and BTBR mice and doing arrays on each of five mice per each of these eight different groups, lean, obese, young, older, and the two strains. And you can see some clear banding patterns in there. And when you cluster these together, you see a subgroup which is related, has a high incidence of cell cycle genes in it, showing different patterns for B6 and BTBR. And if I were a biologist, I'd spend some time explaining this slide, but I don't, you know, I sort of get it. I understand a little bit of the parts of this, but it's not my main area. So I don't, I'm not going to focus on this, but it means a lot to the biochemists. But what I'm going to, what interests me, or what my training is in statistics, has to do with breaking the problem down into key steps. And so I want to just talk about this for a few minutes. Microarrays seemed several years ago as a panacea that were going to solve things. But what the same kind of issues you do in any other study have to come up in a microarray study. Why are you doing this study? What is your data plan? What's the quality of my data? I'll say a few things about that. What are you going to do with the data? How do you manage it? And then the analysis. We often just jump right to the analysis when people come to talk, but I've got to back up and talk about the whole experiment. Why did you do it? What was your design? And then more and more, the issues of access and archiving are becoming increasingly important as we go from having megabytes to gigabytes to exabytes of data hanging around. Okay. So why do omics? I talked about it from the just about that you have to keep design issues in place, but it gives you a chance to go from the forward to the reverse genomics to be able to come up with new hypotheses. But in that, there's some sort of, it's important that we think about having some sort of control experiment. In our case, we had two strains, B6, which was non-diabetic, and the BTBR, which became diabetic. And then looking for differences between those, you look for those differences, and those then generate hypotheses for future testing. But the costs of these are still high. As it stands now, the preparation costs are getting to be higher than the chips, but there's still a tremendous cost involved, and to get the sample size you need does add up. So these high-throughput chips are getting faster, they're getting better and smaller, like the same with the computers, but the cost of people continues to grow. And one of the things that's been valuable at Wisconsin is to have, if I may say so, is have people like myself who can chat with Mike Havey on a daily basis, and then once in a while we get into technical talk and it goes much deeper. And we've worked out a way to talk to each other. And I think that's what this bioinformatics group is about, to try to foster that kind of communication. Okay. So just one slide on sample size. I heard some discussion earlier about sample size and how to do calculations. The calculation that usually is operable is the total amount of money you have divided by the cost per unit. This is Carl Broman's rule. And it seems to hold up pretty well. You can never get enough, and you can only get as much as you can pay for. If you have small sample size due to your cost limitations, then you can only pick up the stronger effects. You're not going to pick up subtle effects. And you just have to accept that. That's just part of the game. And in order to even pick up those strong effects, you have to think about how to limit your question back to the beginning. Okay. So I'm going to go through a step-by-step analysis, what's called EQTL, or expression quantitative trait loci analysis of microarray data that we're still in the middle of, and talk about some of the steps involved and some of the issues that come up. So one issue is looking at your raw data. If you don't look at your raw data, you have garbage in your raw data, garbage in, garbage out. Computer scientists have known that for a long time, and biologists are figuring it out anew. We have thousands of traits now on expression traits. We want to connect those to the genetic information and map them. Okay, and when you start mapping them, you notice that there are hot spots, places that pick up. Are those real? How do you make sense of those? And then if you find a hot spot or you find a number of traits that are functionally related somehow, then you might want to do some more. First, identify those, look for function, and then possibly build causal networks out of that. So I'll just touch on these things through my talk and indicate some of the challenges. And then all of that is data-driven, but we have a lot of other information from protein-protein interactions, transcription factors, other things are growing, particularly for model organisms, and we want to take advantage of that using comparative genomics. These problems get big real fast. They get big in terms of data storage. They get big in terms of computation. And there's a computation to do the analysis, and then there's even more computation to check whether you can believe the analysis. So I'll say some things about that as well. Okay. Now, most of you in here know what an intercross is. You start out with two inbred grandparents. You cross them. And then you take the offspring from the F1. And, of course, with animals, you have to take brothers and sisters. You can't do selfing. We generated 500 of these mice and then did expression arrays on 6 different tissues in these mice. I'm going to first talk about the genetic data. So we used an early Affymetrix chip, which had 5,000 markers on it. Was a huge number at that time. People would laugh at that now, but it's a lot more than people were dealing with by doing them by hand. of those, 2,000 of those were informative, and they're shown here on this picture, generating the map. The nice thing is that now, for a model organism like mouse, you can actually locate where those are physically, and then you can estimate the genetic distance without worrying too much about the order of the maps. And as you can see, there's not uniform coverage. And part of the reason there's not uniform coverage is that the SNPs available were non-informative. There are SNPs between those markers, but they're non-informative for the two species we were working with, two strains we were working with. Okay, now you got your marker map. You put up the genetic information. So there's the 500 mice. And visualization is extremely important part. I'm not going to show you any equations here today, but I'm going to show you a lot of pictures because I think pictures are the key things when you're working with these. Okay, so blue is a B6, red's a B2BR, and green's in the middle. And you can see the recombinations, you can see where the gaps are, and you can start thinking about how much genetic information you actually have across a chromosome. Now, that's all fine and good, but do you trust it? So the genotypes are done based on SNPs. Well, this is SNP data. And SNPs are, you basically have a piece of DNA which differs in the middle, and it differs in the middle for the B6 versus the B2BR. Okay. And then you run through a machine, and you get some score at the end. But you actually, before you get the score, you get the information on this picture here. Okay. So you get a value for the allele 1 intensity, a value for the allele 2 intensity, and then if you look at them together, you're then able to sort out, are these one parent or the other parent? And so blue is one parent, green is the other parent, and red's the het. The figures on the right, those SNPs look really good. The ones on the left are a little more iffy. And there's, if you may not be able to see it from the back, but there's some yellow ones in there that are mistyped. There's some purple ones in there too that where there were problems with the genotyping. And so one of the things we did, and it turned out to be a couple years after we collect the data, we'd already worked with the data a lot. We found out there were some serious problems. We'd done a filtering and found ones that had issues, dropped those off. But then when we went back more carefully and actually looked at these pictures and figured out ways to diagnose, you know, automate diagnosis of these, we were able to discover a number of mix-ups. And one way we found it, which you can do in animals, it's a little harder to do with some plants, is to look at the sex difference. So males are on the top, females are on the bottom. Hang on just a sec. I've got a pointer. Yeah, okay. So there's two little yellow dots up there. Now, they were labeled as males, but this is actually expression trait called exist, which is only found in males. It only expresses in males over to the left. So, I'm not doing well. Okay, so this, it should come down here and be males. Females should be over here. So these two are obviously females that got miscoded as males, and here's a male that got miscoded as a female. So there's some evidence right here that there's some mix-ups. And one possibility is that it was just a mix-up of the labels of males and females. Well, it turned out it was more complicated. The samples actually got mixed up. And so here, this sample should have been down here. And back and forth, there's a whole bunch of mix-ups. There were some duplication of samples that happened. So you got a mix of human error and machine error combined together. And what you get from what you hear about is the error rate's 92% or so, or 95% or 97%. But you still have to check the data. You have to make sure things don't get messed up. And we're not the only people who found this kind of thing. ugly, messy, but it helps to clean it up. Okay. So once we got it cleaned up and we got our phenotypes, then you start thinking about what we can do with this. So we have a clinical trait up here, insulin, which maps on chromosome 19 in the mouse. And then here's an unknown Ryken gene, which also maps on chromosome 19 right near it. So there's a suggestion here that this might actually be, this is an EQTL, this is a clinical QTL, that these might be associated somehow. Here's another one which maps somewhere else, but there's evidence here on chromosome 2 or something. Maybe this is related on chromosome 2. So you start doing some pattern matching and start playing around with it. But before I go into that, I just want to remind you that when we're doing these the QTL mapping here, I imagine many of you are familiar with QTLs, but basically at any particular position, what you're doing is comparing the genotypes, say, at a particular SNP across, and you identify what those SNPs are, and you compare that to the phenotype, in this case an expression trait, and look for differences. Are the differences big? And in this case, we seem to have some slight difference between males and females. Okay, so that's one trait at a time. Here's 40,000 traits. This is about 8,000 traits, actually. Filtered out some that didn't show anything at all. And so before I showed you eight different treatment groups, now I've got 500 mice that each have unique genotype. Okay. And they've been sorted somehow along here. Basically, they've been clustered. Based on, I can't remember how they were clustered. And then this is a clustering which is from Steve Horvath's co-expression modules. And then we pull out again a module here which seems to be related to cell cycle, which we had found from the other study. And we see a gradation here from low to high. And you see a gradation here in the clinical traits as well, insulin being high over here, low over here, and so on. So there are half a dozen traits clinically related to diabetes that are, and then you're seeing these 130 transcripts, which also are showing very similar pattern. So we're connecting the clinical to the expression. When we pull out a subset of this, of these that and do mapping on a subset of these that show strong mapping, we see a number of them. These are a number of genes that are located somewhere in the genome. But this one right here, NeurIM, is located on chromosome 17, so this is acting locally or a cis trait and might be involved in regulating these others. We still don't know, but it's a strong candidate that we're investigating. So you start looking across all the clinical traits, and you see various hot spots, various places that look kind of interesting for different traits. The glucose traits over here, inflammatory traits. Here's liver traits. Hepatic steatosis is a big liver. That much I've learned. And then what you might start thinking about is how do you then relate the expression traits to these clinical traits? Okay, so why are traits correlated? Well, they could be correlated because of some environmental effect, that something having to do with the rooms where the animals are stored, or it could be some physiological relationship that's a dynamic relationship that you're that's bringing in some artifacts. It's also possible that they're genetically related. So one way to think about the genetics is that you have some causal agent, some molecular product, which is then driving a bunch of other molecular products, which then through a cascade leads to down to a clinical trait, clinical differences. Okay, and it's also possible that a different kind of genetics is going on, linkage. So you could have multiple causal drivers that are nearby, and so you get the cascade. You have multiple cascades. I'll show a picture here in a couple slides. Whoops, I'm going the wrong way. So first of all, just getting these terminologies, cis acting trait. It's also called local. You have a change that happens either at a gene or nearby that then leads to a change in the expression downstream. And transacting is acting on a different chromosome coming up. So here's one chromosome 19, and then the gene is on chromosome 7, but the whatever's happening in chromosome 19 is affecting this gene over on chromosome 7. That's transacting or distant. And a pathway, you might have direct or indirect effect from one locus affecting multiple other things. Okay. So with, and there's a direct effect, so you have a gene leading to a gene product which affects expression of other traits, which then might affect other traits downstream. And but you may have more complicated situation where you have multiple starts here. So you have two different things that are changed, and they're leading to two different cascades that are independent, physiologically independent of each other, but they're related because of linkage, genetic linkage. So there's a linkage drag going on between those. Okay, so here's one particular apparent hotspot. We have a bunch of things on chromosome 19 that are located throughout the genome, but they're all showing peaks right in this small region. And then here we have insulin, which peaks in the same region. So the suggestion is that maybe something up here on chromosome 19, a cis-acting trait, is affecting all of these others that are going on down here, and some of that then translates, but it's affecting many of the others, some of that is translating into the clinical trait. So at this point, we're arguing by analogy in a certain degree. I'll get to make that more explicit in a few minutes. So you might think, well, these are just artifacts, but we're looking here at multiple tissues in the same mice and seeing these hotspot bands occurring in different locations for different tissues. So it can get quite complicated. The cis action is along the diagonal, of course. Okay, we'll just skip that. Okay. So a hotspot, I've used the word, but a hotspot is where you have multiple correlated traits that map to the same locus. The question is it real? Or is it an artifact of correlation? And there were a number of papers that came up in the early 2000s that found hotspots here and hotspots there. And it wasn't until 2008 that Richard Janssen and Breitling came up with an argument about how you might test those. And I'm just going to go through that really briefly. We have some modifications on that, which I won't talk about too much. So what you could think about, so most of you who have done QTLs will be familiar with the Churchill-Durge permutation test. And it's the same idea, except you, I'll show in the next picture here. So on the left, we have the genotypes, and on the right, we have the phenotypes, the expression data. And what you physically want to do is shuffle the genotypes. So this is an individual. This individual right here gets shuffled down to this position. This one, you know, ended up here. You shuffle the individuals, and you leave individual genotypes, and you leave the expression data alone. Okay. So you break the connection. You break the connection between genotype and phenotype. And you do that a bunch of different times, and each time you go through the same process of analysis, and then you compare your results. And if they're correlated due to environmental effects rather than genetic effects, you might see something like this, where you see a hotspot in one position, and the hotspot moves to a different position, but it stays the same size. And so if you look at the size of the hotspots in your permuted data, and you find that 400 traits leads you to, that you would could get a 400 trait hotspot by chance, and what you're interested in is a 400 trait hotspot, then you're going to be less excited about that hotspot. So you can come up with a critical value for the size of your hotspots from these kind of approaches. Yeah, that's just a very brief idea. But working on that and going across, this is now going across six different tissues and looking at the go categories, pulling out, and these are a bunch of hot spots that we identified, the ones at the top are the biggest ones. And here's a particular one that shows mitochondrial action. And here's what it looks like in terms of where the maps are. These are just where the peaks are in for individual traits. So each of these circles, I didn't mention before, each of these circles is one trait, where it's located, and where the peak is on that chromosome. And you see this piling up here on chromosome 9. Okay. And this comes from the biologists, of filtering through those traits, coming up with interesting candidates, and looking at possible relationships that come in. So the kind of relationships that could happen is that you have a something that's located on that chromosome which affects another EQTL, another expression trait. Or it could be that the other way around, that you have a reactive. I just want to think about this a different way. So if you have an expression trait and you have a clinical trait, expression trait could cause a clinical trait, or it could be a reaction to the clinical trait. Or they could just be associated, say, through linkage. Okay. So we started to, we were trying to look at whether if you look at a particular position and look at the trait, look at a gene located at that position, how many causal calls would you get looking at other expression traits? How many causal calls would you get in that region? And we found in the same region that several genes showed causal calls. They're listed here. 10 of them that showed causal call, a lot of causal calls, up to 20 causal calls, and they're all located, all tightly linked with each other. So there could be multiple cascades involved here. Rather complicated story. Okay. Here's a much simpler story with a different cross where we had a hotspot where 80 different traits mapped in this small region. Of those 80 traits, 12 of them seem to be gene had 12 causal calls of other traits which were in this hotspot, and then we put these together. What we did was in some other work on causal modeling, we took the 12 traits. Okay, these white circles here are all expression traits, and we basically found QTLs for each of them, and then we did causal modeling, asking whether one is downstream from the other. And I don't have time to go into that. The chief architect of that is Chaibov Neto. But what we did was come up with this network of causal relationships, and in addition, we actually, once we got the causal network, we went back and refigured what the QTL were, and we actually went back and forth between those. So we simultaneously got QTLs and causal relationships. And why can we get causal relationships? Well, we have one chief causal relationship that we're relying on as a genotype drives phenotype. Genotype comes first, at least most of the time. Okay. So we now want to build up to a much larger situation. We want to combine together clinical traits, expression traits, protein traits, metabolite traits, microRNA, and come up with a molecular clinical model. Okay, so in order to do that, I mean, we're now talking about, you know, say we have 1,000 individuals here or 500 individuals. We've got 40,000 here, a couple hundred here, a couple thousand here, couple hundred, a couple thousand, a couple hundred, you start getting large amounts of data involved. And that's only going to get larger. This is before RNA-seq. Okay. So, and the networks get, the amount of data gets larger and the kind of networks you want to look at gets larger. Okay. So when you start dealing with large networks, it takes a lot of time on the computer, you also end up with very complex graphs, and the number of possible graphs rises tremendously fast. I'm not going to go into too much of this, but you can basically limit that complexity a bit, and you can divide it up, as I'll show you here in the next couple of slides. Okay. I'm not going to talk too much about this, but just say that you start needing a lot of resources for doing multiple analyses, for verifying the properties of your methods, and then you also have to store a lot of information. Okay, it may take several hours or days to do a particular analysis. You don't want to be doing that on the fly. You want to store that and be able to pull stuff back. Okay. And then you want to be able to keep track of the stuff you stored. So you start getting into an informatics nightmare here if you're not careful. This is not Excel anymore. We're way away from Excel at this point. And then the other thing is you want to be able to do a calculation. So doing those permutation tests on hotspots takes thousands of hours of computing. So you have to go to Open Science Grid or some sort of clustering, and probably not just your own cluster, but using a national cluster to do this. And the advantage of using such clusters, it's worth the effort because it allows you to free up your mind to talk about the science rather than about the mechanics. Okay? You want to be able to try out a bunch of different ideas in an afternoon or a couple days rather than waiting a month to get your results from one different study. Okay. You can't do it on a desktop. Your desktop should be used for other things, for organizing your ideas. Okay. But you need to have infrastructure at your location or some national or regional infrastructure to make this really work. Let's skip over this. Okay. I guess this is just talking about the complexity. If you have a graph with one parent and many offsprings, that's much less complex than a graph with three parents or five parents. But I'll just leave that. And as you allow more parents upstream, the size of your possible graphs, as you look at bigger graphs, 10 is manageable, 30 is getting kind of out of range. 50 is pretty much impossible unless you really restrict the complexity of your graph. Okay. And so when you start working with these clusters of machines, you have to think about how to break up tasks that can be done that are independent of each other, so-called parallel tasks. Break them up into pieces and put them on different machines, send them out to different sandboxes, as they call them, and then gather the stuff back together. And in this case, we do two phases. We do a bunch of pre-calculations, gather them back together, and then we do a bunch of independent Markov simulations, Markov chains, and then gather those back together. This is all done with clusters of computers. And then you get the results. And this is what it looks like following the computers. We were doing 100 different clusters here. I'll show you the results from that in just a minute. Started out doing the first phase, and then we got up. We're doing this, the actual calculations, and then it all petered out and finished off. And you can actually watch this in process. So here was our first attempt at doing these. I think this was about 25 nodes. We were doing a causal model. And I thought it looked pretty good at first. These are 100 different runs, and they're showing a range of responses. And so each one of these represents a particular chain, a particular possible network, causal network. The ones at the bottom are better, so you pick the one in the bottom. But the problem is that what you'd really like to see is these things mixing around and trying different ones, and they're getting stuck. They're getting stuck at one value without going into details. Some of these are changing and then getting stuck again. This one started out low and stayed low. But it was just different random starts. This one happened to be a good one. There might be one way down here that I would prefer. So after playing around with some algorithms, so the dumb way didn't work. Let's try a smarter way. Smarter way, we ended up with a lot better mixing. And these are all down at the range of that lowest one. But there still is a lot of variation in here and more improvement. So there's a lot of work to be done on the algorithms for these kind of things to make them work well. And that's hard work on my side of the bench. Okay, but it's also rewarding because you get to write papers out of it. Okay, so what about functional information? So there's a lot of different kinds of functional information. There's gene ontology, there's knockout panels, protein-protein interactions, transcription factors. Probably those in the audience could come up with several other possible things. Some of these indicate direction, some of them don't. Transcription factor is going to indicate direction. Protein-protein interaction may not. There are methods that only use this information to build networks. Okay. So what we've been playing around with is using this information as priors, as upfront information to build causal networks, and putting more weight on relationships that are known from other studies, basically. Okay, and that's all I'm going to say about that. I had a slide on equations and decided to take it out. But we have a couple papers. We have a paper that we're finishing up right now for a book on bioinformatics. So comparative genomics, here I'm going to talk about mouse and human. You can think about Arabidopsis or rice or whatever your favorite model organism is where you've got more information. But we're trying to use mouse to probe human and vice versa. Okay. And one of the things that I'll show here is just looking at individual loci, but what the next phase for this kind of investigation by, and a lot of people realize this, is looking at multiple loci. So if you have an enzyme and its binding site, okay, and you know what they are in a model organism, try to find where they are in your own organism and see if there's some sort of interaction going on in your data between them. Okay. And so epistasis interaction. Okay. So there's some problems to be careful about. They may not be comparable. The genes may not be comparable. Certainly the SNPs are probably not. You also have to be careful. I skipped over this, but SNPs can, in an expression probe, can lead to bias in the probe and might even warrant throwing it out. Okay. So here we're trying to narrow our focus for candidate genes that have to do with the cell cycle, where I started out. We have these SNPs that are located. We got 161 genes in SNPs that are in this region. Okay, so here's this region where we're mapping, and then we went to the SNP database at Jackson Labs, found all these different SNPs, and then there's other ones that are in introns, and then I'll come back to that in just a moment. But here's the human data from the GWAS studies showing about 30 different genes that pass the bar, the 10 to the minus fifth bar or 10 to the minus third suggestive of being involved in diabetes. Okay, that have come up from broadcast studies from a couple years ago. And here's one of them in particular, CDKA1, which is located right here on human chromosome 6. Okay. Now, where? So that's all fine and dandy. But let's, and so that's a candidate. Okay. Now, here we are on mouse chromosome 17, and we look at the SNPs that were in here. There were 1,000. There were 20,000 SNPs, okay, in this region. Where do those mouse SNPs, in the corresponding position, where do the genes with those SNPs locate in the human chromosomes, in the human genome? Well, a bunch of them are on chromosome 6 where we're just looking, and that's, you see some hot things here. There's some other at the other end of chromosome 6, but they're spread out across other parts from, you know, where we are not mice, so there's been some recombination between in the process, so they're not all in the same place. So making these comparisons gets a little tricky. So here's the human chromosome 6 region and the tests for GWAS tests, and we're looking at a very small region, and you're seeing the ones that jump up, and there's two particular ones that show up. And then we look in more detail at one of those regions and find a couple different genes here. That there's actually a bunch of genes in here But three of them that come forward, and this notch four is one that we've been looking at in the mouse model as a very promising candidate. But this one is also involved. And as you know, those of you involved in lab work, it can take months of work to investigate one of these. So you want to get to the right ones. You don't want to be messing around, but you don't know which the right ones are. So we have to play this little back and forth. And that's one reason why the chatting that I was talking about early with Mike is so important. We have to develop a relationship of trust with Alan Addy, where I can say, I really don't know, but these are my best guess, and let's see what happens with it. Okay. And he has to develop enough understanding about what I'm doing through dialogue over years to have a sense that of how strong my thinking is on that. Because he's going to then go off and talk about these things with collaborators who might know something about Notch 4 and might be able to work with him on that. But he has to decide to go for Notch 4 versus BAT 3. Okay. How are we doing on time? Am I... 5 minutes. Okay, so I'm just on time then here. So these are a bunch of collaborators that work together. Most of this work was involved with Alan Addy. Many of the slides were prepared by Mark Keller, who's a scientist working in Alan Addy's lab. Carl Broman. Okay, some of the work was done, particularly the genotype, was done by Carl Broman. And his wife, Amy Broman, is actually a scientist working on this project as well. I've collaborated a bit with Gary Churchill at Jackson Labs and also with Ninjin Yi at University of Alabama in Birmingham. Several of my students have come through this project or are working on it now, and there's other people have been involved peripherally as well. So with that, I'll stop and thank you and ask for questions. Yes.
You have talked quite a bit about locating effects and detection primarily, but you haven't talked much about evaluating the effects of those
right.
associations, or however you want to call them. Is there much work in actually looking at evaluating the effects?
Well, I mean, typically the validation is a biological validation, right? And I'm not a biologist, so I sit in on those meetings. But but there are various things that are done. So if you're looking at expression trait, you can go to the parent strains and do RT-PCR, and we have done that. Or look at tissues, look at knockouts. I stayed away from going into those kind of issues because that's not really my expertise. But yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do the validation, a lot of important work that has to be done.
And I'm thinking more of, in a quantitative model,
yeah.
You would estimate variance components, parameters,
yeah,
things,
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah, we do those kind of things. I just left those details out. You know.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're tools to investigate those things. You know. How big are the effects? So first you want to find out where things are happening and whether they're big enough to be important, and then you would go in and look at the gene action in detail and see either in terms of variance components or additive and dominance effects and epistatic effects. But those tend to be pretty straightforward once you've decided what to look at, but deciding what to look at is really hard when you've got so many things out there, so many... straws of hay out there to look for. Yes?
I wanted to ask you again, when you had the cause for that you were in the permutation test,
yes.
you kept your EQBL data together.
Yes.
And you were randomizing the genotest. Was the genotest you were randomizing for a one locus at a time?
No, you randomize for each. You shuffle the labels of the individuals. So what you want to do is keep all of You want to keep all the genotype data for an individual together. You want to keep all the phenotype data for an individual together, because the correlation between the genotypes is what gives you the linkage. Okay, and the correlation between the phenotypes is what gives you the network relationships. So those are important to keep together. What you're breaking is the genotype as a causal agent for the phenotype.
So the same thing we do with blocking proxon, we have correlated traits. The same here could be a blood product, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And should be. Yeah. I mean, yeah, okay. I'll leave it at that. Other questions? Okay. Thanks very much.